Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On January 23rd, 2 days after the Women's March and on his first full day in the White House, Donald Trump signed an executive order to reimpose the Reagan-era global gag rule. Since 1984, every Republican president has reinstated the global gag rule, and every Democratic president has rescinded it. The rule prohibits the use of U.S. federal funds for international family planning agencies that either provide abortion-related services or even mention abortion to their clients. But Donald Trump's rule goes further. The new rule includes not just family planning organizations, but all global health organizations that receive U.S. government funding. Today's guest, Françoise Girard, says Trump's global gag rule will reverse decades of progress on reproductive, maternal, and child health, leading to an increase in unintended pregnancies, unsafe abortions, and maternal and newborn deaths worldwide. Françoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that advances the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and young people, particularly adolescent girls, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. And Françoise Girard joins me in studio. Hi, Françoise. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I wish I was talking to you under better circumstances because this is very, very serious. A lot of people are not familiar with the global gag rule. Before we talk about the fact that Donald Trump made it even worse, just give us an overview of what the global gag rule is.
This is a rule imposed by Republican presidents since Ronald Reagan. It began, as you noted, in 1984. And it's known as officially as the Mexico City policy because it was first adopted in 1984 at the time of the Mexico Conference on Population and Development. And the purpose of it is to silence organizations working on reproductive health on the subject of abortion. That's why it's been nicknamed the global gag rule, because it really serves to gag organizations and silence them. And the way it works is if an organization abroad received funds for family planning from the U.S. government through USAID, through the family planning account, it could no longer even speak about abortion, refer clients for safe abortion services, counsel them. It couldn't even have a pamphlet in the waiting room in the clinic explaining safe abortion options. And even worse in some respects, or perhaps even more shocking in some respects, considering this is the American government doing this, it prohibited these organizations from engaging in democratic debates in their own country about the liberalization of abortion laws, you know, which is a debate that's been going on in a lot of countries in the global south. So that's how that's worked traditionally. Of course, what that has done is basically put organizations in the position of accepting U.S. funding but providing substandard care or incomplete reproductive health care, because abortion is an integral part of providing reproductive health care to women. Or if they refuse the money, well, then of cutting their services to part of the people they were serving, because obviously U.S. government funding is quite significant. Now, under President Trump, we have something that is much expanded, as you noted. So the funds that used to be affected were about, you know, currently $600 million of family planning funding. But now he's expanded it to all the global health assistance provided by the U.S. government. And while that's what the executive order says, and they haven't yet issued the detailed regulation, so we'll see exactly what the contours of that are and whether or not some organizations are exempt and so on. But at the moment, if you just take it at face value, it covers all the HIV funding by the U.S. government, malaria, tuberculosis, maternal health, newborn health, nutrition, you know, all these accounts, and that could come up to $9 billion a year of funding that is now conditioned by this. And what is interesting to know also, and some, and just so you know, we were talking to European governments about this because, of course, they're very concerned, and it affects their funding as well, because what the rule says is that if you accept U.S. government funding, you can't do these things anymore at all.
At all.
No matter whether or not another donor, like the Danish government, is funding you to provide comprehensive health care. So it seeks to condition all of your funding and all of your activities. And you can't sort of separate, you know, keep separate books, you know, and hope to escape the clutches of the global gag rule that way. You really basically have to make this terrible, difficult choice.
And so, again, we're talking about, because it goes further, we're talking about $9 billion?
Potentially, yeah. And we'll have to see when they are going to have to issue detailed regulations, because you can't implement the executive order the way it's written. You don't know exactly what is covered. So we'll see. But if it is as broad as it looks like it intends to be, and we have reason to believe that they absolutely intended to cover HIV funding, we're talking up to $9 billion, because just the money that's spent abroad on HIV and AIDS by the U.S. government is currently $6.8 billion. You know, that's one of the major global health accounts.
This didn't get much attention because so much has happened under this administration.
Right.
Can you tell us specifically, what was your reading of this executive order?
Well, I have to say, at the International Women's Health Coalition and the rest of us in the global health arena, we're expecting the global gag rule to be reinstated, because that's happened with every Republican president since Reagan. But we didn't expect it to be this broad, to cover all global health funding. When, you know, a lot of us now are trying to figure out how this will play out in the field, in Africa in particular, which is the continent that is the biggest recipient of HIV funding. Because now HIV funding is in play, we're trying to figure out what this will mean. But I'll tell you a couple stories of partners of the International Women's Health Coalition. We fund women's groups providing health services to women in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East, as you noted. And these groups also engage in advocacy, you know, to try to improve the policies and the laws in their own country to ensure women have access to life-saving services. And there's two groups we were talking to who we support, we fund, about the choices they're going to face under the global gag rule. One of them is a group called EVA, Education as a Vaccine. So the acronym is EVA. They're based in Abuja, the capital of Nigeria. It's a group led by young people. And the CEO is this young woman in her 30s. And she was telling me, you know, and they run this hotline for young people, where young Nigerians call to ask for information on sexual and reproductive health. And they've become a really trusted organization, because they'll answer any question. Mm-hmm. And often these young people have no choice, because, you know, if they ask their parents about abortion or sexual orientation or sexual violence, they'll get in trouble with their parents. And, you know, it's still a very conservative society, so they really don't want to turn to their parents. And often their teachers in school are not very well equipped to answer these questions either. They'll answer with, you know, they're schooled, the kids. So they called the EVA hotline. And EVA was hoping to get some funding to expand its HIV education. So they're hoping to tap U.S. government HIV funding. But now they're in the position of saying, well, if we do that, then we won't be able to answer questions on abortion when young people call the hotline, which is, of course, impossible, right? You can't have young people call you and say, well, we can answer all these questions, but not the question about abortion, sorry, because they'll lose all credibility. And when, of course, they don't answer the questions, young people will turn to the internet and to clandestine providers or quacks, or, you know, and end up in situations where they, you know, are going to, young girls are going to risk their lives and their health at the hands of these quacks. So now they're going to have to forego that money, which means they won't be able to expand their operations and serve more young people. So that, you know, that's one example. The other example is a group called KMET in Western Kenya. It's the Kisumu Medical Education Trust. And KMET runs a clinic, a reproductive health clinic, and also vocational training for young girls who've dropped out of school as a result of unwanted pregnancy. And they also train doctors in reproductive health services. And they currently have a grant from USAID, from the U.S. government, under the maternal health budget line to train obstetricians in preventing and stopping postpartum hemorrhage, you know, when you have uncontrolled bleeding after delivering your baby. And that funding is about $200,000 a year. So they've used that funding to train doctors to save women's lives. And on the other hand, in their clinic, they provide comprehensive care, including abortion referrals and information about abortion. So now they have to choose. Either they continue to provide comprehensive health care and they have funding from other donors to do that, or and they give up the funding to train doctors in postpartum hemorrhage, or they continue with postpartum hemorrhage treatment, but, you know, they have less money. So, you know, the European donors are not going to be very happy, you know, about, you know, having their funding for the clinic now, you know, condition with this, you know, restriction on even mentioning abortion. And of course, and as providers, as doctors, they don't want to tell women who come and see them, yeah, sorry, we can't answer your questions. Again, it's untenable. If you're a doctor who's providing care at the community level to women, you're dealing with women's real circumstances, and you don't want to be gagged that way. And the other thing is, with both of these groups, they've participated in debates on health policy at the national level and you know, national parliaments and so on, and they don't want to be prevented from bringing the experience they have at the community level of what women and girls are dealing with on the topic of unsafe abortion to those debates, you know, and that's what the Global Gag Rule would do.
How will the United States monitor this? I mean, if these organizations cannot mention abortion to their clients, who in the United States keeps track of this?
Well, obviously, you know, they may not know of every occurrence, right? So you could imagine groups taking chances, but ultimately, and this has happened in the past, the U.S. government has missions locally. You know, USAID has some representatives in the country, and they, when you certified in the, you know, in the former incarnation of the Global Gag Rule, when you receive U.S. funding under these conditions, you have to certify that you won't speak about abortion and so, and you agree that you will allow U.S. government officials from Washington or from, the, you know, let's say the ones that are based in Nairobi in Kenya, to come and visit your clinic, to observe your activities, to audit your documents, to speak to your staff. So, you know, there is a risk that something could be uncovered. And certainly, the risk is great, because if you are found to have violated the conditions, you have to reimburse all the money. So for an organization that's already spent the money providing health care to women in their community, they don't have $200,000 that they can return to the U.S. government. Oh. You know, it would put them under.
Françoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that advances the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and young people in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. We're talking about Donald Trump's executive order to reinstate the Global Gag Rule, which happens under every Republican president since Ronald Reagan, but this one goes even further. You were talking about specific examples, and let's talk about what happened under George W. Bush, who actually got a lot of attention for his HIV programs in Africa, but this didn't get as much attention. According to the Guttmacher Institute, when George W. Bush reimposed the Global Gag Rule, the U.S. Agency for International Development was forced to cut off shipments of contraceptives to 16 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. At the time, one in four women in Lesotho were infected with HIV. The contraceptive shipments to Planned Parenthood in that area, the only available conduit for condoms in the country, ended as a result of George W. Bush's actions. He created more unwanted pregnancies and more babies with HIV. This is according to the Guttmacher Institute, and Trump's action is likely to do the same.
Right. As I, you know, the impact I describe really affects organizations that are on the ground at community level providing comprehensive reproductive health care, and that includes contraception, condom provision, HIV counseling, maternal health counseling, you know, antenatal care, et cetera, postnatal care. And for the organizations that are not prepared to sign, you know, to agree to the global gag rule, they lose funding. And that means less contraception available, fewer services, fewer women served. And the evidence that was collected under George W. Bush was pretty clear that in the countries that were most affected by the global gag rule, we saw a decrease in the use of contraceptives. You know, that's the immediate impact. And we saw an increase in unsafe abortions as a result of that. But, you know, the consequences for women's lives were, of course, broader. If you think of, you know, not being able to control your fertility, having to see dangerous providers, being subject to unsafe abortions, that's, you know, that has a lot of repercussions for the health of women. The other impact, of course, is that if you don't have access to condoms, if the organizations that provide the barrier methods, right, condoms are defunded, you have more exposure to HIV in high prevalence settings. And Lesotho is in southern Africa. It's mm-hmm. a country that has a very high HIV prevalence rate. That, of course, will be the result. I mean, that's pretty clear. And there's been several good studies that have shown that that's been the impact. And now, of course, we're magnifying that multiple times, so we're going to see really adverse health consequences.
The Washington Post had a good story about how countries in Africa will be affected. Africa is home to two-thirds of USAID's family planning priority countries. Mm-hmm. And the nations that are likely to be hit the hardest include Mali. You talked about Nigeria, Congo, Zambia, Tanzania, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Madagascar. The list goes on. And they report that in Kenya, public health experts raised immediate concerns about this new policy. Women in Kenya often resort to dangerous methods to end their pregnancies, including drinking battery acid and mm-hmm. using wire coat hangers. Mm-hmm. In parts of rural Kenya, young women have hired local healers to stomp on their stomachs until the pregnancy is deemed over.
Yes. Women will go to extreme lengths to end an unwanted pregnancy. And in a country like Kenya, which I know quite well, There's actually a pretty high rate of maternal mortality. You know, Kenya may appear from the outside to have a pretty good health system, but in fact, on the issue of maternal health, Kenya is really lagging behind. And one of the reasons for that is the continued high number of unsafe abortions. So that contributes greatly to the rate of maternal deaths, especially in young women. And, I mean, if you look at this globally, you know, unsafe abortion remains a very significant problem, a public health problem, especially in the developing world. There's about 20 million unsafe abortions in the world. That's what the World Health Organization estimates happens every year. Wow. And the vast majority of them, like 95% plus of them, take place in the developing world. So to then specifically target the countries where women already have, you know, limited access to comprehensive reproductive health care, to impose these punitive measures specifically in those countries to silence health providers, nurses, doctors at the community level on this important topic is just unconscionable.
How are clinics planning to deal with this, especially the ones that are already struggling to find funding? What are you hearing from those clinics?
They know they're in trouble, yeah, because these funds won't be easy to replace. The U.S. is a very significant donor in global health, and so they're really scrambling. They've turned to the Europeans. You know, the European donors right. have already mobilized. For example, the Dutch Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lilian Ploumen, has announced a new fund called She Decides. And the idea is to mobilize other governments in Europe and elsewhere to compensate, you know, to make up for some of that at community level, and to also raise money from the public, the general public, to compensate. But even she admits that it will be difficult to replace the U.S. funding because it's so significant. So there will be clinic closures. There will be many women who lose access to services. In some of these countries, the clinics most likely to be affected, for example, the ones associated with the International Planned Parenthood Federation or with Mary Stopes International, those are two organizations that are likely to be very directly impacted. These clinics are the only clinic, you know, around. So, and there's no other clinic that's going to step forward and provide comprehensive reproductive health care, right? So it's a net loss.
You mentioned Denmark. There have been stories about Belgium, Finland, Canada, Luxembourg. So we're talking about $9 billion. That's how much money needs to be raised at this point?
Not necessarily, because the global gag rule affects the $9 billion, but the funds that will be cut, you know, the de facto, the organizations that will refuse to certify and therefore will lose their funding, that will be probably less than the $9 billion, because many organizations faced with the choice will choose to certify and sign up and will agree to be gagged. Yeah? So it's not the full $9 billion, but it will be still a substantial amount. We'll know probably in a couple of years exactly how, you know, this will have played out, but we're talking certainly tens of millions of dollars.
Tens of millions.
For sure.
Okay.
A minimum. Yeah.
And how is it rolled out? Because when I read about the executive order, I was thinking, well, when does this go into place? At what point do these clinics have to make a conscious decision and stop talking about abortion to their clients?
The way it's going to work, we think, again, we haven't seen the regulations, which will provide much more detail. But in the past, the way it worked, it was that every time a new contract was signed, you know, providing U.S. funding to that foreign organization, usually through a U.S.-based group, you know, it usually works that way. You have a principal recipient, which is a U.S.-based organization, which then has sub-recipients abroad. Then at that moment when the contract is signed or a new funding action, you know, new disbursement takes place, is usually when the organization, the foreign organization, has to certify. In other words, sign the document whereby the organization agrees to no longer speak about abortion or provide any abortion referrals and so on. So it rolls out over time, typically. That's why I'm saying we'll know more clearly in 18 months to 2 years how the full contours of the new global gag rule. But based on what happened last time, when it was much more limited under George W. Bush, we know that it will lead to clinic closures because we saw that last time. We know that there will be less access to contraception and to condoms, you know, leading to a higher HIV infection rates, as you noted, and also an increase in unsafe abortions.
Françoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, and today we are talking about the global gag rule. 2 days after the Women's March, Donald Trump signed an executive order to reimpose the global gag rule, but he decided to take it even further. The rule includes not just family planning organizations. All global health organizations that receive U.S. government funding cannot talk about abortion, and they cannot provide abortion-related services. This is a pre-taped Your Call. Unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls. We'll be back after this.
Listening to a pre-recorded Your Call here on 91.7 KALW. No calls, please, but your feedback is always welcome. Send an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, my guest is Françoise Gérard, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. That's an organization that advances the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. And today we are talking about the global gag rule. Since 1984, every Republican president has reinstated the gag rule. Every Democratic president has rescinded it. This rule prohibits the use of U.S. federal funds for international family planning agencies that either provide abortion-related services or even mention abortion to their clients. But Donald Trump's rule goes even further, and this is the first time that we've ever seen this. The new rule includes not just family planning organizations, but all global health organizations that receive U.S. government funding. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. And Françoise, we are airing this on International Women's Day. It's kind of amazing, shocking, and unacceptable that in the year 2017, there are 225 million women in developing countries who want to avoid pregnancy but are not using contraception. Mm-hmm. They don't have access to it.
That's right. They don't have access, and they face a range of barriers to their access. So even... And that's, I think, important because often the issue is presented as the, you know, contraceptives are not available at their local clinic, or there may be no local clinic. So that's certainly one aspect of it. But quite often also these women find that in their relationship or in their family, they cannot control decisions about their own health, right? Yep. And they need to have permission from a husband or a partner, etc. So there's a range of, or they're not free to move about, you know, and go to the clinic without the man accompanying them and so on. So there's a range of barriers to access to contraception which really lead to this result of 225, at least 225 million women wanting to limit their pregnancies, or, you know, to prevent pregnancy and not being able to use modern contraception.
And that's just across the board without the global gag rule.
That's,
is that right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, pre-global gag rule.
So the number will go up with this global gag rule.
It will.
And even higher because Trump's taking it even further.
That's right. So we'll see how this where this goes. And I think it's important to understand that in my view, all of this, you know, this global gag rule has to be understood as part of this drive to control women, right? Because if it was really about abortion, then that's not the, you know, that's not the measure you would take. You know, you would actually fund greater access to contraceptives and really support the organizations that counsel women and support them to prevent pregnancy. But in fact, the results of the global gag rule, as we've seen in the past, are to actually increase the number of unsafe abortion, because the net effect is to decrease access to contraception. So that's a tip-off to me that it's about something else, which is this notion that women should be controlled, and that, you know, women should be, can't, you know, the notion that they should be making their own decisions about their bodies, fertility, and sexuality is at issue. So once you start to look at what's going on with that lens, I think a lot of other things become clear.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you how you explain, or how you're making sense of this, because Donald Trump has appointed extreme anti-choice politicians to his cabinet.
That's right.
And even 8 years ago, Republicans rarely said that they opposed abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. And now they openly embrace this extreme position.
That's right. It's the platform of the party.
Right. So how do you explain this?
Well, to me, that, again, is because it's not about abortion. I think some of us, but not me, but, you know, in the general discourse in this country, I think people have become persuaded that abortion is the issue that they're very concerned about. But when you look at the range of measures that the Republican Party has endorsed, and you look at the makeup of Trump's cabinet, you see that they actually are interested in defunding organizations that provide comprehensive health care, like Planned Parenthood clinics, right? Mm-hmm. And even though since the 1970s, no federal funding has gone to support abortion in this country, right? So this is the Hyde Amendment. And the same exists at global level, by the way. We have since 1973 the Helms Amendment, which does the same thing, basically makes prevents any federal funds from funding abortions directly abroad, right? And the same applies in the U.S. with the Hyde Amendment. So that restriction has been in place since the 70s. It's completely wrong in my view, but that's already in place. So when, you know, for example, they talk about defunding Planned Parenthood, or what they're saying is preventing Medicaid reimbursement from going to Planned Parenthood, they're attacking the full range of comprehensive health care that Planned Parenthood provides. And that, to me, is really about controlling women's lives and restricting women's access to services that allow them to limit, you know, the number of births and really continue to go to school, enter the labor market, you know, participate in public life, political activity, and so on. So I think it's pretty clear to me that it's about restricting women's freedom and autonomy.
I'm noticing that there are a lot more anti-choice women who are now speaking on these issues. For example, when there's a Supreme Court decision, there's a woman who's anti-choice, who's the spokesperson for these organizations. How do you explain that?
Well, women, you know, live in their own context, right? And many women have not really unpacked these questions of gender equality and haven't appreciated the impact that not being able to control your body and fertility has on the rest of your life. Perhaps because they have, in fact, been able to control their body and fertility and they can just put that aside. But in where we work at the coalition in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East, we see very clearly the detrimental impact of not being able to access contraception or a safe abortion. You know, women die, right? And women can, you know, young girls drop out of school in droves, etc. So the impact is very stark because the access isn't there. I think we've forgotten that in this country, you know, because some of us have gotten maybe too comfortable. But that's what it means when you cut women's ability to control their bodies, fertility, and sexuality. That's exactly the result. Women are not able to realize their potential and be active in society.
This also affects refugees. In some cases, so many of the women who will be affected by this are victims of sexual violence, including refugees who've been raped. According to the Guttmacher Institute, every year about 1.6 million women are targeted for complications from unsafe abortions. And so can you talk also about how refugee women will be affected by this?
In this country?
No, overseas. And just women needing access and how they'll be affected by the global gag rule.
Yeah, one of the biggest gaps in humanitarian assistance still is providing comprehensive reproductive health care to refugee women. Because when women are fleeing, they're not leaving with their pills, you know, their contraceptive pills. They're leaving with nothing. Mm. And on the way, of course, you know, they're subject to exactions and extortion and being asked for sexual favors and you know, and raped, frankly, as condition of passage and so on. So women, and there are many pregnant women, you know, fleeing conflict and humanitarian disasters. But even basic things like, you know, access to sanitary pads, you know, while you're moving, are far from guaranteed. And it's still the case that humanitarian assistance neglects women's concerns and, in particular, reproductive health. Now, one of the things that I think is worth mentioning in what we expect from the Trump administration is the fact that they also have indicated that they will cut funding for agencies like the United Nations Population Fund. They haven't done that yet, but we expect that will be coming when the budget proposals are put forward. And UNFPA has been one of the leading organizations providing reproductive health care, including menstrual you know, products, commodities like sanitary napkins to refugee women and women who were displaced. So that's, you know, we're going in the wrong direction for sure. Mm. That will make the situation much worse for these women.
What about funding that's directed to anti-abortion groups in places like Africa? Do you think that funding will increase for these organizations?
One thing is that I think we can expect, and I'm thinking about how the HIV funding went under George W. Bush. You know, the Bush administration, we can credit them with having created the PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS, the AIDS response, the big, the $6.8 billion of HIV funding that's largely due to the President Bush's, you know, initiative in 2003-2004. And, you know, the PEPFAR has been reauthorized since and increased greatly. But at the time, when it was created under George W. Bush, prevention funding had to focus on abstinence only until mm-hmm. marriage and faithfulness in marriage and you know, in stable relationships. And condoms were, you know, just mentioned, you know, as a subsidiary intervention. So, you know, if you couldn't abstain and couldn't be faithful, then maybe you could use condoms. And there was also a provision in the law that created PEPFAR that allowed organizations to refuse, that receive funding from the U.S. government to provide HIV prevention. They were allowed to invoke conscience and not to, to speak about condoms if they objected to that. So basically, you allowed organizations that were prepared to provide incomplete care from receiving, you allowed them to receive U.S. government funding. And at the time, that favored faith-based organizations, religious groups, and a substantial portion of the funding went to these groups that were promoting abstinence. And what the impact has been, of course, is it's that it's been, well, first of all, it didn't work. You know, it doesn't work as HIV prevention. It's been a colossal waste of money. The Stanford School of Medicine did a study of the abstinence-only funding under PEPFAR during the Bush era. And what they found was that $1.4 billion were spent in abstinence-only programs, and that those programs had absolutely no impact on the sexual behavior of the people who were subjected to these messages. So what you'll do is you'll pour a lot of money into these organizations and into these programs. It will not work. So that's certainly a grave concern. I mean, if we're talking about efficiency and, you know, effectiveness, that we may be looking at a revival of these kinds of programs that don't work and are actually really detrimental because they do stigmatize discussions, honest, open discussions of sexuality, like the ones that our young people in Nigeria want to have, you know, on their hotline. Mm. You know, if you're supposed to be talking about abstinence until marriage, you're not meeting young people where they're at because that's not their reality.
Do you expect this administration to try to regulate sexual behavior like we saw under the George W. Bush administration? I'm not talking about abortion, but promoting marriage, for example, like we saw in the Bush administration, promoting more abstinence. Things that clearly don't work when you look at science.
Yeah, and facts. I see no reason you know, that they won't do that. Mm. You know, I think we can expect a lot more of that. I mean, that's a non. It's still very much part of federal programming to this day. You know, if I mean, we have to remember that welfare reform under Bill Clinton in 1995. If you read the welfare reform legislation at the time, it included substantial funding for abstinence only until marriage programs. And that's where that came from, you know, the big increase in funding for abstinence-only programs in this country, and also promotion of heterosexual marriage as a way to reduce the welfare rolls. That was part of that legislation. So, I expect it will only increase, but I think there's been fault on both sides of the aisle on that front.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what are your thoughts on the Democratic Party's response to all of these attacks? to the global gag rule, to what we're seeing overseas. And I can't help but, as you're talking, think about what we're facing in the United States, where in some states there's one clinic. I have reported on issues where a young girl asked her boyfriend to hit her stomach so she would have an abortion. I mean, this is real. This is happening in this country.
Well, I think we're seeing, because citizens are marching and are coming to town halls and are calling their representatives, I think we're seeing much more response and reaction than we have in the past. But we need to see much more. I think we need to see a wholehearted, full throat defense of reproductive rights, I think, and of sexual rights, you know, because we're also facing these attacks on young trans people, and we can't tiptoe around these issues anymore. We can't keep them separate from the rest of women's rights. It doesn't work. It's wrong. And so I'm hoping that we'll see much more, you know, forceful and brave and bold defense of the full agenda.
Françoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that advances the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls. Today, we're talking about the global gag rule, which was reinstated by Donald Trump just 2 days after the Women's March. And every Republican president reinstates the global gag rule. Every Democratic president rescinds it. But Donald Trump's rule goes further than even George W. Bush. This new rule includes not just family planning organizations, but all global health organizations. That means that they can no longer provide abortion-related services or even mention the word abortion to their clients without losing their government funding. And so we're talking about what effect this will have on women around the globe. Françoise, what are your thoughts about the message that this sends to the world? Because Donald Trump, this was one of the first executive actions he took.
Yes.
2 days after we saw women, not only in the United States, but around the world, in places that we didn't expect. Sometimes you had five women taking to the streets.
Even in Antarctica.
Exactly. I mean, what message do you think he wanted to send people signing this just 2 days after those marches and his first full day in the White House?
Well, I think he was signaling the very conservative base that he had made a deal with, you know, during the campaign, that he was going to deliver for them and that women's lives and women's health were fair game for him. So what we're seeing at the global level is a lot of consternation, of course, and shock that the U.S. is prepared to use women's lives and women's health in this way as a political football. And we're also hearing from other governments, because we at the International Women's Health Coalition do a lot of work at the United Nations with other women's organizations, and we're hearing a lot of concern about what positions the U.S. is going to take at the global level, at the United Nations going forward, when we discuss women's health, women's rights. And we'll see. You know, we have this month, in March, the Commission on the Status of Women, which is, you know, an annual meeting, a two-week meeting of all governments to discuss women's rights globally. We'll see what the Trump administration comes up with. But there's a lot of concern that we're going to once again see the positions that were characteristic of the Trump, the Bush administration in the 2000s were very regressive statements by the U.S. government on women's rights. You know, the U.S. government officials standing up in negotiating rooms and saying, you know, we only support natural family planning methods, or we support abstinence only until marriage, as U.S. policy. You know, that's the kind of statements where we might see again. And that's just incredible, I think, to your audience to hear this.
Yeah, in 2017. Yeah. Are you finding that right-wing forces in other countries that have the same extreme agenda are emboldened by
Absolutely.
Donald Trump?
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
People like Mike Pence and Jeff Sessions?
Absolutely. And, for example, few days after the election, we work with women's organizations in Egypt, groups that are really embedded at the community level, providing legal assistance to women on matters of custody of children and divorce and access to services and so on. And 2 days, and General al-Sisi, the leader of Egypt, was the first foreign leader to call Donald Trump to congratulate him after the election. And 2 days after the election, there was a crackdown. I mean, there was already a crackdown on civil society in Egypt. That's been going on for a while. But a real amping up of the crackdown with a focus on women's rights organizations. So they started arresting feminist leaders. They started freezing the bank accounts of these organizations. They've banned several of the feminist leaders from leaving Egypt. So when they show up at the airport to leave the country, they're told that they cannot leave anymore. They can't travel freely. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this started to really ramp up 2 days after Trump's election. And, I have to say that the day after the election, we got messages of condolences from some of our feminist colleagues in countries like Turkey, where they're dealing with their own megalomaniac autocrat. And they really said, we're so sorry that you're going to have to go through this. We know what you're going to deal with. If you want to talk about strategies, we're happy to discuss how we've survived so far and what we can all do together. But yeah, it emboldens other autocrats elsewhere, because if the U.S. is not going to stand up for women's rights and for democracy and for freedom of the press and freedom of association, then they feel they have a freer hand for sure.
Do you have any comments on media coverage of these issues? Because, I hear this term pro-life thrown around. Some media organizations don't use it. They'll use abortion advocate, abortion opponent. But what are your thoughts about media? Because media really shapes opinion of people who might be on the fence about this issue.
I have to say, I really don't want to paint all media with the same brush.
Right.
Obviously, we have a full spectrum,
yeah,
including organizations like yours, Rosa. But I feel there's better coverage of these issues by certain specialized media this time around than there was in the past. There's a real thirst for understanding what is exactly happening and what are the ramifications of it. So I find that there is interest. Now, the problem we face, of course, is that the media landscape now is much more polarized than it was, in 2000 or before, and that people only listen, to the media that corresponds to their or well-established views, right? So there's hardly an opportunity to be challenged, and confronted with real stories of what the impact is on women's lives of, some of these policies. So that's what I'm concerned about. But in terms of the organizations, the news organizations that are really paying attention to the detrimental impact on women's lives, I find that there's a real thirst for going in depth and understanding what's happening.
And we have just a couple minutes left. I'm sure that so many listeners are wondering what they can do about this. What do you think is most effective?
Well, I think it's important to understand that what happens at the global level to women abroad is intimately connected with what's happening to women in this country. Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see that, right? Mm-hmm. That the issues are very similar when you hear of defunding organizations abroad providing comprehensive reproductive health care. It sounds like what's happening here, with defunding of Planned Parenthood clinics. So really understanding that we're all in the same boat and we all have to stand in solidarity, then I think really taking action at all levels, contacting your representatives, expressing your concern about what's happening in this country and what's happening abroad and making the connection, and saying, this is unconscionable and I disagree with it here and I disagree with it in Kenya, Nigeria, or Lesotho. And really also making the point that respect for sexual and reproductive health is a core part of women's rights. And it's not something else. We need to stand for the full agenda of women's rights.
Françoise Girard is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, an organization that advances the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and girls in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. Find more information about their work and the global gag rule at yourcallradio.org. Françoise, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for your work. We'd love to check in with you maybe in a couple months to find out how clinics are dealing with this and to find out how women and girls are being affected.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on produced today's show. Stephanie Porcel is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulip is our studio engineer. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.